Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Today, I'm going to talk about a number of topics, including the career of Cian Xuxian. I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He was a Chinese aeronautical engineer, aerodynamicist, cybernetic expert, and is the reason why China has such advanced hypersonic missiles. And by the way, and I'm going to get into this, Cian Xuxian was trained in the United States at MIT and at Caltech. And he actually was a key member of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And he was actually a member of the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board, which I've spoken at length of in the past. In fact, Cian Xuxian was a protege and close colleague, in fact, some would argue the right-hand man of Dr. Theodore von Karman. I've spoken about Dr. Theodore von Karman a lot in the past, and it's an interesting story how he wound up going back to communist China and basically kickstarting their weapons program, their missiles program. Cian Xuxian is considered the father of Chinese guided missile development. We'll be talking about this so-called drone invasion. Yes, some of them are drones. The drones stick out like sore thumbs, if you ask me, but a great many of the videos I've seen, those are not drones. Those are either actual alien craft. I would say most of them are actual alien craft, and some are advanced craft, man-made craft, based on alien technology. And the usage, the verbiage of the word drone has caught on like wildfire because of the general ignorance of the truther community about aliens and UFOs, their generally skeptical attitude about it. All they need to hear is the word drone, and they just go on automatic pilot. The term drone is a loaded term because it implies that all of them are man-made. It implies that all of them have no crews, no occupants. That's a big call. That's a huge assumption to say that every single one of these craft we're seeing has no pilots, no crew members. And some of the craft I've seen, especially the lighted orbs, that kind of thing, we've seen those types of craft for a long time. Some of them, to me, are absolutely 100% alien craft. The ones that are more drone-like, like the one that apparently crashed in New Jersey, that whole thing could have been a stage setup like Shanksville, Pennsylvania. You have all these cop cars there, and this thing conveniently settles down on the road. It doesn't even break up. Pictures are taken of it, of course, and they call that a drone that crash land. It reinforces the meme. So when they use the term drone, and then the hysteria that comes about as a result of using the term drone, hysteria coming from a lot of simple-minded, surface-level truthers who look askance when they hear anything from the corporate media. They are always bitching and moaning about how the media lies, etc., etc. And yet when the media says these are all drones, they just take it and they run with it because they're simpletons. That's called confirmation bias. These surface-level droolers are brainwashed into not believing in the existence of aliens. So when the media says drones, and when they drone on endlessly about drones, well, the surface-level types will go, yeah, we're down with that. They're drones. So one byproduct of this drone invasion, so-called, is, well, it's basically kick the congressional inquiry about UFOs, oh, excuse me, UAPs, to the curb. And the irony is, there were UFOs filmed over the Capitol building where the hearings were being held. It's almost like the aliens are just laughing at them. So we have this drone invasion, so-called, and it leads directly to the tanking of the whole disclosure movement, disclosure concept, the congressional inquiry on UFOs, all that gets kicked to the curb. And in its place, we have all this hysteria about drones. But the term drone itself is a loaded term. but it works wonders on simple-minded surface-level truthers. I'm here to say, a number of those videos I've seen, I'm satisfied those are alien craft, or at least piloted or controlled, remotely or otherwise, by non-human beings. Some of them may be advanced craft based on alien technology, based on the analysis and back engineering of alien technology. And some of them are drones. I will grant that much. Some of them are so drone-like, it's not even funny. They just add a few lights to it and what have you. But some of the ones that are behaving totally UFO alien-like, those are on another category entirely. Why is this happening? Why is there a worldwide upsurge in UFO activity? I've always said that at some point the aliens are going to reveal themselves, not necessarily like, here we are, we're aliens, that kind of thing, but just a mass worldwide sighting. And this is not the first worldwide global UFO flap. The old term flap means a high number of sightings in a particular geographic location for a protracted period of time. Not just 1 or 2 weeks, but, you know, several weeks, a few months. And there have been worldwide UFO waves. And there have been UFO waves in particular places. In Italy, the 1950s, France in the 1950s, different places in America are ongoing. But ones that come to mind are Westchester County, the Boomerangs, upstate New York, the Hudson River Valley sightings of the triangular craft, Pine Bush, New York, upstate New York, a lot of triangular craft involved. This happens periodically in certain places. Certain places are going to be hot spots. My feeling is that at some point the aliens have decided, and perhaps let it be known, because always remember, folks, there has been ongoing interaction between certain elements of the deep black military aerospace, upper cabal level hierarchy with, for lack of a better term, aliens. This ongoing relationship, ongoing alliance, if you will. And I'm reminded of the events leading up to Pearl Harbor. Let me explain the point of relevance and the parallels that I see. The Americans, a lot of people don't realize this, but the British actually made the initial inroads into solving what became known as the purple diplomatic cipher. At any rate, the Americans, under the team of Frank Rowlett, Abraham Sinkoff, they built a purple decryption machine sight unseen. They didn't have a working model like the British had. The British actually had Enigma encipherment machines to work off of. The Americans didn't. They built a machine from scratch, and it was able to read the top-level Japanese diplomatic ciphers, which was given the code name the Purple Cipher. And in those decrypted messages leading up to the Pearl Harbor attack, there was message traffic between the Japanese embassy and Japanese ambassadors in America and the Japanese foreign ministry in Tokyo, the message traffic that was going back and forth. And at one point, I'm paraphrasing, I can't remember exactly what they said, but I remember the key term exactly. And that term was, things will start to happen automatically. Things will start to happen automatically. And what they meant was, if these negotiations with the Americans didn't come to pass and some kind of treaty was put in place, if that didn't happen by a certain date, things would start to happen automatically. And we saw the result of that, because the Americans had no intention of coming to a treaty or agreement for the Japanese. They wanted the Japanese to attack. And boy, howdy, did they. So the thing that happened automatically was the attack on Pearl Harbor. Point of relevance is, my feeling is, and there could have been some adepts, and there could have been some reptilian hybrid shapeshifters in the hierarchy posing as humans, and this could have been gleaned from the interaction between deep black elements and certain ET groups, but some ET groups had decided that at some point things were going to start to happen automatically. And I've always felt that the celestially driven cataclysmic timetable, planet X, the second sun, a lot of those things factor into this. So let's say in our example, this hypothetical example, that the ETs decide, okay, well, things will progress up to a certain point, and then we'll make our big move, because they know there's going to be a further huge culling of the surface population. It's ongoing. So many people have gotten the treatments, all these wars going on and everything else. There's this constant negative louche that's being exuded, which is being hoovered up, soaked up by a lot of these archontic negative entities. So they know that there's going to be this massive, mega, Bill Deagle level culling of the population, a continual culling. So the ETs are going to make their move. And I've also been saying for some time that we're going to see open warfare erupt in the skies, and probably on the ground as well, between rival ET factions, ET groups. And one video I saw, and there's no way I could confirm the validity of it, but it seemed legitimate to me. There were some lighted orbs in the sky. This is New Jersey again, somewhere in New Jersey. And either one orb was ejecting a number of smaller orbs, or the other orbs were coming out of a portal. Something was going on. At any rate, after seemingly ejecting a few other orbs of the same size, essentially, the ejector orb was blown up. It just exploded. So who blew it up? Was it the result of a malfunction, or did something destroy it? I think as time goes on, we're going to have that twilight of the gods, the wars on heaven and earth, the wars of gods and men. About these sightings, in the old days when there was a big UFO flap, the media either studiously ignored it, or if the sightings were so widespread, so many people had seen them, and especially as we went into the era of the videotape recorders, the camcorders, and then later on they were miniaturized, people started carrying around the little digital cameras. When footage of all these UFOs came out, and it was impossible to deny because the media would do the usual ignoring or do the ridicule. And if the sightings and the public interest persisted to the point of hysteria, and that's what we have now, all these surface level types in a state of hysteria. So if things start to get into the red zone, as far as hysteria level was concerned, then the deep black government would resort to initially bringing out their stable of debunkers. The stable door would open and out would pop out James Oberg, the late unlimited James Oberg, the late unlimited Phil Klass, the late unlimited Joe Nickell. May they all rot in hell. All of them professional liars. All of them fit a psychological profile as a debunker. So they would roll them all out. Susan Blackmore was another one. There were so many of them. And then if that didn't quell public interest, the old ridicule and bringing out the debunkers and quackademics to rubbish the whole concept of mass sightings of UFOs, then what they would do oftentimes is resort to some stratagem or some kind of trickery. They would find some highly skilled pilots. They would fly in close formation in light planes, maybe add some woo-woo colored lights, and then there would just happen to be someone on the ground to videotape this. And of course, that video would be splashed all over the major television media. Look, this is what's going on. It's a group of pilots flying in close formation at night, and they're behind this hoax, whoever they are. And we saw that in the wake of the Phoenix Lights. I think they use that in other parts of America, other places, that or a similar stratagem. And also, they would, besides the Joe Nickells and James Obergs and ad nauseum, they would roll out these woo-woo big shot military experts to say that, oh, it's just flares or a military exercise. We also saw that in the wake of the Phoenix Lights. One of the latest screwball, talk about a conspiracy theory, is this notion that, oh, what these drones are really doing is they're monitoring for nuclear materials, radiation, a dirty bomb, a suitcase nuke, and that's what the heightened alert status is all about. That's what the drones are really doing. That's nonsense. Of all these surface level truthers and all these so-called influencers and podcasters, I've never heard a single one of them talk about the nuclear emergency support team. The Nuclear Emergency Support Team, also known as NEST, NEST. It is a branch and agency within the Department of Energy. Let me read to you from the Department of Energy website. Nuclear Emergency Support Team, NEST. The Nuclear Emergency Support Team, NEST, is NNSA's multi-mission nuclear emergency response capability that leverages the Department of Energy's world-class scientists and technical experts to contend with the nation's most pressing radiological and nuclear challenges. NEST is the umbrella designation that encompasses all DOE, NNSA, radiological and nuclear emergency response functions, some of which date back more than 60 years. These include all field deployed and remote technical support to the nation's countering weapons of mass destruction operations, including preventive nuclear and radiological detection and threat-based nuclear search, public health and safety missions, including radiological consequence management and responses to U.S. nuclear weapons accidents and incidents. Additionally, NEST maintains operational capabilities that enable nuclear forensic analysis of nuclear material used in an improvised nuclear device or interdicted outside of regulatory control. What that means is NEST's job is to precisely to go out and find these nuclear threats. NNSA stands for National Nuclear Security Administration, and within the National Nuclear Security Administration, there is a counterterrorism and counterproliferation group. And let me read again from the website. The NNSA's Office of Counterterrorism and Counterproliferation is integral to the U.S. government's layered defense against nuclear terrorism and nuclear proliferation. I'm having problems pronouncing proliferation. That's called CTCP, Counterterrorism and Counterproliferation. CTCP scientific capabilities help provide early threat indications and inform the security of nuclear materials worldwide. Its operational assets are used to locate and defeat terrorist nuclear devices and mitigate the effects of radiological incidents around the globe. This defense-in-depth strategy requires adversaries to defeat multiple layers of security to obtain and detonate a nuclear device. NNSA's nuclear counterterrorism, counterproliferation, and incident response missions harness the department's unparalleled command of nuclear science to understand and contend with nuclear threats. CTCP performs three core functions: preparing for nuclear and radiological incidents and accidents through planning, training, and exercises, countering adversary efforts to acquire and use nuclear capabilities, responding to nuclear and radiological incidents and accidents worldwide. CTCP manages the Nuclear Emergency Support Team, NEST, a cadre of on-call technical specialists who are trained and equipped to respond to all manner of nuclear events. Notable NEST capabilities include mobile teams that can search for nuclear devices based on a variety of signatures and threat intelligence, as well as technical personnel whose knowledge of nuclear weapons is used to characterize and defeat the device. NEST also performs a variety of public health and safety missions providing technical guidance to federal, state, and local officials following nuclear incidents by providing dispassionate scientific advice during fearful events. Nest equips decision makers with the knowledge to save lives and help the public recover quickly from crisis. Further down, it reads, CTCP supports a broad range of U.S. government planning efforts for nuclear and radiological contingencies as part of this responsibility. The office provides liaison officers and expertise to Department of Defense combatant commands. Through its capacity building programs, CTCP strengthens domestic and international preparedness to respond to nuclear and radiological incidents and accidents, whether due to malicious acts, accidents, or natural disasters. The office also leads technical and policy engagements with allied foreign governments to advance global nuclear threat reduction priorities. And then you go to the page that talks about the liaison officers. They work with U.S. Special Operations Command, Joint Special Operations Command, Defense Threat Reduction Agency, STRATCOM, or Strategic Command, and the various theater commands, Indo-Pacific Command, U.S. versus Korea, Central Command, European Command, Africa Command, Southern Command. In all likelihood, they work with Delta Force, also known as Combat Applications Group, AG, because I've listened to former Delta operators talk about exercises where they actually had to break into underground bases and try to retrieve a dummy nuclear device.
That
faceless unknown expert was blowing smoke about the drones being used as aerial platforms to detect radiological devices, radioactive nuclear material. Well, let me read to you from the Department of Energy website about how they do that. The aerial platforms they use, I'm sure they have other aerial platforms, not just what's listed. So let me continue. The Aerial Measuring System, AMS, is a rapidly deployable capability that can respond to all manner of nuclear incidents and accidents in the United States and overseas. It is part of NNSA's Nuclear Emergency Support Team. AMS consists of a fleet of aircraft equipped with specialized radiation detection systems to provide real-time measurements of air and ground radiation contamination. AMS scientists, technical personnel, and pilots are on call 365 days per year, 24 hours per day, to deploy in response to nuclear incidents and accidents. AMS aircraft are outfitted with state-of-the-art communications and radiation detection systems. These capabilities ensure that AMS science teams on board can communicate in real time with experts at the national laboratories and support rapid protective action decisions. The AMS fleet includes three Beechcraft BN-350 extended-range fixed-wing aircraft and two Bell 412 rotary-wing aircraft stationed as needed at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland and Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. Following a release of radioactive material, AMS can provide the fastest and most complete picture of radiological conditions that may impact public safety and the environment. The data that AMS provides is often the first scientifically defensible and actionable product that federal, state, and local officials can use to support health and safety decisions, such as evacuation and shelter-in-place guidance. As part of its dual public safety and national security mission, AMS frequently supports preventative nuclear and radiological detection operations in preparation for high-profile events such as the Super Bowl, the National Political Party conventions, and the presidential inauguration. AMS heritage dates back to 1958 when the Aerial Radiological Measuring System, ARMS, was established to support the U.S. Geological Survey. The first operational use of this capability occurred in support of atmospheric nuclear weapons testing at the Nevada test site when ARMS aircraft mapped the distribution of radioactive material. After U.S. nuclear testing moved underground, ARMS was used to confirm that radioactive materials were not released into the atmosphere. Later, ARMS transitioned to a rapid response capability to provide time-critical data to decision makers during a radiological emergency and became known as AMS. One such deployment involved the use of AMS helicopters during the response to the Three Mile Island accident in 1979. I think that was actually sabotage, but that's another story. Although they say that the 1950s was the first time they actually deployed such aircraft to detect radiation samples. As far as I know, it was not the first time that was ever done. Operation Crossroads, I believe 1946, Marshall Islands. There was supposed to be a series of three nuclear tests, and they had drones, actual drones. These are aircraft that were remotely piloted, were made to fly through the mushroom cloud and pick up radioactive samples. So a little bit of history there. I'll tell you what they don't do. They don't send up a bunch of brightly colored drones coming out of the ocean, clusters of brightly lit drones, in order to generate a wave of hysteria in order to quietly find and neutralize nuclear threats. It defeats the purpose. But all it takes is some faceless, so-called expert. This is confirmation bias and is also the appeal to authority, a mysterious unnamed authority in this instance, which is a logical fallacy. All it took is for some faceless, nameless somebody to put a post on to a Facebook group, put up about these drones, which miraculously, virtually overnight, gained 20,000 members, and then this faceless nobody of an expert says, I know exactly what these are. These are drones that are sent out to monitor for any suspicious nuclear radiological nuclear suitcase nuke activity. And that's nonsense. The sightings from witnesses, the testimony of witnesses, are being once again ignored. The police officer or sheriff who stated that he saw 50, upwards of 50, illuminated objects come out of the ocean. The airline pilots, air crews, who were seeing clusters of UFOs above the cloud layer, 30, 35,000 feet. The reports of these objects passing over cars and homes and interfering with the electronics. So there's an EMF issue, electromagnetic emissions issue. Reports of some of these objects spraying some kind of an aerosol. This harkens back to William Bramley, Gods of Eden, when he went back and looked at the chronicles from centuries ago during the plagues era. And prior to the onset of the plagues, chroniclers were describing objects flying through the sky, leaving behind a mist, spraying. They were a chem spraying. Before too long, the plague breaks out in those places that were sprayed. Bramley also talks about how humanoids with tanks on their backs were seen by people at the time spraying some kind of gas or some kind of aerosol onto the crops on the ground. There is a video of a UFO flying at high speed along one of the rivers in New York, and it was clocked at twice the speed of sound, Mach 2. Yet, no sonic booms, no car alarms going off, no shattered windows. Remember what Dr. Hermann Oberth said. Hermann Oberth was a mentor to Wernher von Braun. Hermann Oberth became a consultant to the U.S. Army's Missile Development Agency at Huntsville, Alabama. And he said, for the record, that the reason why UFOs, flying saucers, can make these right-angle turns, instantaneous right-angle turns, instantaneous change of direction, no sonic boom, etc., is because they create their own gravitational field. Keep that point in mind. Multiple orbs and objects are seen coming out of some of these so-called drones. And there have been instances, and this has been videotaped, of orbs blowing up after blasted with some kind of unseen weapon. Other videos showing what appear to be a regular drone going up to investigate, I guess, and then the regular drone gets shot down and falls out of the sky. Drones that are being sent up by drone operators, their batteries are dying and they're falling to the ground. So there's definitely an EMF electromagnetic aspect to this. And getting back to the radiological aspects to it, I just spent a great deal of time talking about the Department of Energy's NEST team, Nuclear Emergency Support Team, et cetera, et cetera. This is why I made a point, belabored the point, actually, about the origins of the Department of Energy and the Defense Nuclear Agency. It's gone through a number of name changes that evolved out of the wartime Manhattan Engineering District, the Manhattan Project. Post-World War II, Truman signs into law, Manhattan Project is broken up, the civilian aspect becomes the Atomic Energy Commission. which, after a number of name changes, becomes the Department of Energy, and the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, based at Sandia, New Mexico, undergoes a number of name changes. At one point, it was called the Defense Nuclear Agency. Point being is that from its inception, these organizations, going back to the days of the Atomic Energy Commission and the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, were deeply, deeply involved in the back engineering analysis of recovered alien technology, and also studying the radiological effects associated with UFOs, alien craft. And I've spoken in the past about how members of these SEDs, special engineering detachments from Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, even though they were wearing hazmat suits, by merely being in close proximity not only to the alien bodies, but also to the technology itself, they got severely ill and died. There has always been a radiological EMF aspect to real alien, or at any rate, non-human craft. That 1994 Federal Fire Marshal's manual came out with a chapter specifically devoted to the dangers associated with crash-landed or landed or hovering UFOs, dangers about the radiological effects. I am sure within Department of Energy, there is a branch or a sub-agency that deals specifically with alien crash retrievals, that they're part of these crash retrieval teams. When they secure an area, the DOE, and in concert with federal fire marshal units, seal off an area, along with the military, of course. So this whole concept of EMF, of radiological issues associated with the UFOs, is well embedded and is part and parcel of the history of the Department of Energy. So it's ironic when these people go around blowing smoke about, oh, these things are just drones looking for nuclear weapons. Now would be a good time to discuss the possibility of nuclear war and how the ETs would factor into that. We need to go back in time to 1954, when Eisenhower had his meetings with ETs at Muroc Field, which later became known as Edwards Air Force Base. And apparently, at least one type of ET that Eisenhower met with on that occasion, I had Paul Blake Smith on my show a few times, and memory serves, this would have been March 1954, but don't quote me on that. And the ETs, according to Meade Lane, who was present, he was a member of Borderland Sciences, and he was deeply interested in the UFO paranormal subject in general. And he claimed to have been there at Muroc Field. And the accounts of other people, Bill Hamilton talked about one of his sources, a guy named Sergeant Suggs, a technical sergeant from the Marine Corps, took part in a crash retrieval in the early era of America's involvement in the Vietnam War, 1958 timeframe. They recovered a craft in Vietnam. It was placed on the deck of the carrier USS Oriskany, brought back to, if memory serves, my dad's old stomping grounds, Naval Air Station Alameda, where in the old days they used to park some of the aircraft carriers there. Sergeant Suggs' father, apparently, according to Sergeant Suggs, was a member of the Office of Naval Intelligence, a captain, and had accompanied Eisenhower to Muroc Field / Edwards Air Force Base. During this meeting with the ETs stated to Eisenhower they wanted to make their presence felt and reveal their existence to the global population, kind of a mass manifestation, if you will, all over the world. Eisenhower argued strongly, vehemently against that, saying that the public was going to panic, institutions, financial institutions, religion, etc., was going to collapse. We've heard all this before. The ETs also offered an alliance. They said, we'll help you fix everything. World hunger, wars, provide free energy, technology, etc. But first, you have to get rid of nuclear weapons. There's that subject of nuclear weapons again. It's very interesting that a number of the contactees, and I really feel if we're going to give the UFO subject its due, the issue, the subject of the UFO contactees of the 40s and 50s and 60s especially, that whole era needs to be reevaluated. Too many so-called serious researchers of the NICAP and APRO variety in the old days, they not only looked askance at those critically important contactee cases, they were outright dismissive and generally rubbish, the whole concept that a saucer would land on a deserted road somewhere, a hitchhiker. They invite the hitchhiker on board. The aliens look perfectly human, perfectly underlined three times. Give them a tour of the ship, fly them around, sometimes even take them to another planet, bring them back, and oftentimes they would leave them with a message. Please tell your leaders to stop testing nuclear weapons. It's not only damaging, irreparably damaging your world, but it's damaging other worlds, not only in your plane of existence, your dimension, but in other dimensions too. Contactees were told this over and over again by the friendly, seemingly friendly ETs they encountered back in those days. That was the norm back then. I'm sure that the Greys were still abducting people, because I'll get more into that also, because it seems like, and I don't want to jump ahead, that Eisenhower knocked back one group of ETs, but he seems to have made a deal with another group of ETs. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So contactees were told over and over, you must tell your leaders, you must tell your governments to stop testing nuclear weapons. You're not only destroying your world, but it's having a disastrous effect in other worlds, in other dimensions. So naturally, Eisenhower nixed that whole concept. Much is made about Eisenhower, the big hero, warning about the military-industrial complex. He was the military-industrial complex. Don't get me started about all the things he did in World War II, all the things he did just on a surface level after World War II. The ability of these different ET groups, some from this dimension, this cosmos, and some from other dimensions, their ability to detect nuclear detonations on our planet may have been the motivation to start exploring this planet, checking it out en masse in 1946 and 47. We hear so much about the drone invasion these days, but there was likewise a worldwide UFO wave, especially centered around America in 1947. And it should come as no surprise that Roswell was the site of a crash retrieval. What's at Roswell? At the time, the world's only nuclear-equipped atomic bomb wing, the 509th Bomb Group, which was part of the 8th Air Force, was part of the Strategic Air Command. So Eisenhower knocks back a deal with ETs that want to help us out, help humanity out, on the condition that we give up nuclear weapons development. And then he eventually makes another deal with another group of ETs that have no qualms about the humans developing nuclear weapons. And then I'll get into now what these different alien groups, because I'm assuming there was more than one, did as a result of the continual development of nuclear weapons here on Earth. They began a mass surveillance operation against nuclear missiles sites, nuclear missile development centers, weapons plants. Shortly after World War II, a number of the Atomic Energy Commission production facilities at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and at Hanford, Washington, began having sightings of unknown objects, either hovering over the plant or flying over it. In particular, one type of aerial vehicle or aerial object was described as a green fireball, and these green fireballs were quite numerous, and they seemed to be flying over such sites, Oak Ridge, Hanford, Los Alamos. It worried officials in the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy, and the FBI. They convened a secret meeting, and the project was dubbed Operation Twinkle, and they called in a top scientist, Lincoln La Paz, from the University of New Mexico. Lincoln La Paz was an astronomer who was regarded as the world's leading authority on meteorites and bolides. La Paz spoke to a number of eyewitnesses, including technicians, laboratory personnel, scientists, physicists, and security personnel, and he studied the available data, including photographs and whatever else was available, and he determined these were not meteors or meteorites. There was something else. They seemed to be taking sensing shots over these sensitive facilities. Fast forward to the 1960s, then we have stories from Robert Jacobs, who was in charge of a photographic unit at Vandenberg Air Force Base in Ventura County, I think it is, Central California. Some of you may know the story, but it bears repeating. He and his team were filming the launch of a missile that was launched out of Vandenberg in the Big Sur area and was going to head towards a Pacific missile range out in the middle of the ocean. Well, they thought they had had a successful launch because they were able to capture the imagery on radar. They didn't get to see the film that they shot. 2 days after the launch, Lieutenant Robert Jacobs was called into the office of his boss, a Major Mansman, and there were two plainclothes individuals in this office. They played a projector that showed the launch they had filmed, and while this missile was soaring up into the sky, a flying saucer flew into the picture and blasted the nose cone with four separate beams of light. And then the missile went off course and fell out of the sky. He was ordered never to talk about it. And he found out later from Major Mansman that the two civilian guys, I'm guessing CIA, snipped off the section of film that contained this missile flying at high speed that was disabled by a flying saucer. This is an important point to make. This thing literally flew rings around a ICBM in flight. It had a dummy nuclear warhead, and it shot beams of light at the nose cone of the missile, proving without a shadow of a doubt that at least one group of aliens has the means to mess with ICBMs in flight. We have the testimony of then Lieutenant Robert Salas, and I think he retired as a lieutenant colonel, don't quote me on that. He was in a launch control facility at, if memory serves, Malmstrom Air Force Base, 1966. The aforementioned missile incident with a flying saucer occurred in 1964. What happened to Salas occurred in 1966, where up to 10 nuclear missiles in their silos were knocked offline and went into a no-go status. Eyewitnesses on the ground reported seeing unidentified flying objects flying around in the restricted airspace over the launch sites and also hovering over sensitive areas of the launch facilities. Understand these missile silos are spread out over several hundred miles, so they don't get all taken out by one nuclear blast. Somehow, some way, this interference from these UFOs caused 10 missiles to go into no-go status, what they call a fated giant. Okay, that's a national security issue right off the bat. Linda Moulton Howe tells a similar story also at Malmstrom. I can't remember if it occurred before or after Robert Salas's experiences, but she says her brother told her, who was stationed at Malmstrom at the time, that a UFO hovered over a nuclear missile silo and it caused the electronics to go off. They had to physically remove the missile from the silo in order to repair the parts that had malfunctioned. Raymond Fowler, a great UFO researcher, he wrote the series of books about Betty Andreasen, the late Betty Andreasen Luca, Andreasen Affair and Andreasen Affair 2, The Watchers 2, etc. Raymond Fowler was formerly with the Air Force Security Service, which is the Air Force subsidiary to the National Security Agency, and his job for a government contractor, I can't remember if it was Westinghouse, Sylvania, one of those, was to work on these ballistic missiles, the electronics. He was told by colleagues in his field that his colleagues had known of cases where missiles were tampered with, missiles in their silos were tampered with by these unknown flying objects. And then you fast forward again to 1975. The Northern Tier SAC bases were coming under intrusions from unidentified flying objects from Loring Air Force Base in Maine, all the way to Malmstrom, Montana, Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, and other places along the northern tier of the Strategic Air Command missile or nuclear bomb bases. A number of low-level incursions happened where unknown flying objects flew over the restricted airspace, flew over nuclear launch control facilities, flew over nuclear weapon storage areas, hovered over them, flew over other sensitive areas. And when jet interceptors or helicopters were sent, these objects either just blinked out or they departed rapidly. You can read details about this in the classic book by Fawcett and Greenwood called Clear Intent. The title was later changed to The UFO Cover-Up. The book Clear Intent slash UFO Cover-Up was made up almost entirely the facts within it from documents pried out of the government via the Freedom of Information Act. And they also had some eyewitnesses who spoke on condition of anonymity. And then you have the RAF Bentwaters Rendlesham Forest case. If memory serves, that would have been right around this time of the year, December 25th, 1980. And it was the third of three successive nights. And many of you are familiar with the story, but it bears repeating. The base was on high alert because of the activities involving UFOs the previous two nights. And then on the third night, a craft actually landed in a clearing known as Capel Green. It was surrounded by about 40 Air Force personnel, including Larry Warren, who I've had on my show a few times. Larry was within touching distance of the landed craft. He was there when three aliens came out of the craft and stood face to face with Colonel Gordon Williams, who later became a general. And elsewhere on the base, I think it was the same night, in the weapons storage area, underground weapons storage area, UFOs were hovering over the storage area and beaming lights down into the underground facility, sending the personnel inside the weapons storage bunker into a frenzy, as you can imagine. And what's the significance of that? Once again, it bears repeating, RAF Bentwaters at the time was the largest repository for tactical nuclear weapons in Europe. I've spoken to an ex-Army Special Forces soldier who had been tasked by the Defense Intelligence Agency to conduct covert operations in South America. He was a fluent Spanish speaker. He said he was at Fort Hood when there was a big UFO event involving dozens of personnel, UFOs flying all over the place. Whole base went on alert, and the next day, just as we've seen in other cases, the personnel were shipped far and wide. They were transferred to sent out, posted far and wide after being debriefed, threatened, etc., etc. Point of relevance, for many years, Fort Hood, Texas, was a repository of nuclear weapons. Let me read to you a bit about Killeen Base, which is near Fort Hood. This is from the website globalsecurity.org, Weapons of Mass Destruction, Killeen Base, Site Baker, Gray Air Force Base, Robert Gray Army Airfield, Killeen, Texas. During the beginning of the Cold War, Killeen Base was one of the Air Force's storage and assembly bases for nuclear weapons. Gray Air Force Base, near the AEC's Killeen Base, Atomic Energy Commission, Killeen Base, Site Baker, one of three national stockpile sites where nuclear weapons were stored at the time. Routine maintenance and assembly of nuclear weapons produced small quantities of contaminated waste. These wastes were placed in lead-lined cylinders and stored in underground tubes. The low-level burial sites at West Fort Hood are considered low risk by the regulators and do not warrant remediation. And moving on, it says, the airfield, which is approximately the size of an average Air Force installation, actually belonged to the Air Force from 1947 to 1952. From 1952 to 1969, the airfield and facilities were run by the Army under the Defense Atomic Support Agency. Defense Atomic Support Agency was one of the iterations, one of the name changes of the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project. You see the connection here. The Killeen Base was an Atomic Energy Commission site. It was later run by the Army under the Defense Atomic Support Agency, which underwent a number of name changes, Defense Nuclear Agency, etc., etc. It became an actual part of Fort Hood in 1969. And like I said, I spoke to this ex-Army Special Forces guy who was based there when these UFOs besieged the place. Somehow, some way, these aliens know where the nuclear weapons and nuclear components and fissile materials are stored. Your average truther doesn't know where these materials are, but somehow these aliens know where they are. Oh, and before I forget, let me backtrack and talk about the series of sightings which plagued the aircraft carrier USS Franklin Delano Roosevelt, beginning in 1952 and continuing till about 1962, a full-on decade, the ship was being plagued by near-constant UFO sightings. Turned out that the carrier FDR was carrying nuclear weapons. Go figure. So to recap, what is going on? ETs of various stripes have wanted to stop nuclear development on Earth. Failing that, they have closely monitored the development, the progress of the development of nuclear weapons and thermonuclear weapons on Earth. They have a proven track record of disabling nuclear weapons in the silos.
They have proven the ability to not only make nuclear missiles in silos go into a no-go status, but they can also mess with the launch systems and make the missiles go into the preliminary countdown into a launch. They have disabled ICBMs in flight, literally flying rings around the nose cone, shooting beams of light at the nose cone to disable the ICBMs. Some ET groups, embodied by the reptilian hybrid plantation managers that run this planet on behalf of their reptilian Draco masters and the latter's cosmic vassals of different stripes, different ET groups, want nuclear war. They want nuclear war between the United States and Russia, the United States and China, the United States and Iran. I haven't had time to get into depth about it, but Dr. John Brandenburg has proven to my satisfaction that there were at least two extremely large thermonuclear airbursts on Mars, which had wiped out a surface population millions and millions of years ago. So that means at least two planets in our solar system, the Earth and Mars, have had serious ET problems. Dr. Brandenburg found very large quantities of xenon 29, argon 40, which suggests that thermonuclear detonations had taken place on Mars. Such quantities are not naturally occurring. They could only have come about as a result of a very large thermonuclear explosion or explosions. Despite the claims that these drones, so-called, are nothing to worry about, drones are interfering, so-called drones are interfering with air travel. Airfields have been shut down. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, of all places, where they actually keep alien technology and alien bodies, was shut down due to the drone activity, so-called. I'm talking about the air travel in and out of Wright-Patt, and also the fact that air bases in England and other places have likewise been messed with by these craft, by these orbs, by these UFOs. It's not strictly relegated to America. This is happening all over. People are reporting electromagnetic effects when these so-called drones fly over people's homes, fly over people's cars. The clocks in the homes inside the cars are stopping. When people are sending drones up, real drones, to investigate, the drone batteries are running out. People are reporting getting sick from being in close proximity to these drones. People have reported seeing these so-called drones emitting some kind of fumes or some kind of aerosols. This harkens back to William Bramley's information in The Gods of Eden. Jeff Brady has talked about this. I've talked about this. Eve Lorgan have talked about this in relation to William Bramley's work. What's the significance of that? William Bramley showed in his book, The Gods of Eden, that prior to and during the onset of the plagues centuries ago, eyewitnesses and chronicles of the time had seen craft flying through the air, leaving what we would now call chemtrails. Moreover, people on the ground back in those days were seeing humanoid beings with tanks strapped to their backs actually spraying crops in areas where eventually the Black Plague, bubonic plague, developed and caused mass death. This could be a replay of that. There is a risk of all-out nuclear war. Indeed, we've seen again and again how the powers that be, the hybrid reptilian plantation managers, want nuclear war, all-out nuclear war. We are getting reports, and I've seen video of these so-called drones again, these UFOs actually shooting at each other and having battles over the skies of Las Vegas and other places. I've said years ago, I've maintained for some time, we will begin to see open conflict in the skies. But because of the talismanic invocation of the term drones, that has really muddied the waters because of all these surface-level dweebs who've been brainwashed into thinking things such as Project Bluebeam exist. Now, the public, and especially the surface-level truthers, have been detuned from the all-important fact that not only aliens really exist, these Bluebeamers don't believe aliens exist, and if they don't believe aliens exist, to them, the notion of an all-out alien takeover, alien invasion, an alien attack is out of the question. It is so far-fetched to them that it is complete nonsense. I just spoke a moment ago how Dr. John Brandenburg has proven that very, very large thermonuclear airburst occurred millions of years ago on Mars. There's no other explanation to explain the large quantities of xenon-29, which can only have come about as a result of atomic fission on a mass scale. During a book signing, a public appearance, the late, great George Carlin was asked his thoughts about the events of September 11th, 9/11. And he said, I do not accept, I'm paraphrasing here, he said, I do not accept an accepted narrative, an accepted explanation of what's going on when it's being parroted and when the mainstream media become an echo chamber pushing the same narrative over and over and over. Al-Qaeda, terrorism, Osama bin Laden. We have the exact same thing going on today. Drones, blue beam, drones. It's a narrative that's being pushed by the mainstream media. And notice how these blue beamers, these surface level types, have accepted at face value what the mainstream media and what the government is saying, that these are merely drones. These blue beamers have become de facto an arm of the disinformation apparatus. They have become propagandists for the government, for the world government, for the reptilian hybrid plantation managers. Well, we have a real serious issue involving non-human beings who are making a bold, big move. Those of us in the know are aware of the fact that there is an ongoing interaction between deep black elements of the military aerospace community, occulted fraternal orders, secret societies, and aliens, non-human beings, particularly reptilian beings. At some point, either the reptilians and other ET beings told their human hybrid counterparts, we're going to make a move. You deal with it any way you want, but we're going to make a big move at a certain point. Or it's also likely or possible that these non-human beings told their hybrid plantation managers, you will use the drone excuse. You will use the excuse of drones, blue beam, etc., in order to create a smokescreen to muddy the waters when we make our big move. And I believe that's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing a big move all across the board. Once again, the eyewitness accounts are being disregarded. Law enforcement officials talking about swarms of illuminated orbs, upwards of 50, coming out of the ocean. Airline crews and pilots and passengers seeing clusters of illuminated UFOs at 35,000 feet or higher. To be forewarned is to be forearmed. What I see happening, I don't want it to happen, but I can easily see a scenario where at ground level, a light source will appear, a bright light source. Some info warrior surface level type blue beamer will say, oh, that's just a hologram, blue beam, walk towards it, walk into the light. The light instantaneously retracts into itself, blinks out, disappears, and takes the blue beamer with it. And then the blue beamer winds up in the Middle Ages or in some other dimension entirely. Ignorance is not bliss. Or another scenario that I can see play out is there's a low-hanging, hovering, or landed real alien craft, and some blue beaver says, oh, that's just a drone, walks up towards it, and then winds up with an extreme case of radiation poisoning, starts bleeding out through all of his or her orifices, and dies. To be forewarned is to be forearmed. Ignorance is not bliss. Sun Tzu said, if you know yourself and you know your enemy, you need not worry the outcome of 100 battles. And these blue beamers are barking up the wrong tree. Every time you see a video now of what I consider to be a real UFO, it's accompanied by the emoji laughing at you symbol, all these blue beam dweebs chirping about how it's just a hologram or blue beam, a fake alien invasion, etc., etc. When this country, this planet, this world has been under a reptilian sphere of influence for thousands, if not millions of years. Okay, in the time I got left, and I'll wrap it up really quickly, I need to talk about Dr. Xian Xiu Shen, I'm sure I'm butchering that name, who was the father of the Chinese Missile Development Program. He came over to the United States under the Guggenheim Aeronautical Laboratory Grant Program. He became a protege of Dr. Theodore von Karman at Caltech, was one of the founding members of the Jet Propulsion Lab. He was sent over to Germany after World War II, and he was commissioned, actually momentarily for the time being, in the U.S. Army, where he brought back information about the German advanced missile programs and the swept wing jet program run by the Germans. He'd actually spoken to and debriefed Dr. Wernher von Braun, and he brought back one of the largest supersonic wind tunnels the Germans were working on. Dr. Hsien Tzu Shen had actually inspected the underground Dora works, the Mittelwerk, in the Hertz Mountains, where the Germans were developing the V-2 rocket. In fact, not only did he arrange to bring back a horde of missiles and missile components and the documents related to the missile development, but also arranged to bring back a number of the technicians, engineers, and scientists. He was a member of the Air Force Scientific Advisory Group under Dr. Theodore von Karman, later became known as the Scientific Advisory Board. He worked at some level with the Manhattan Project. In short, Dr. Hsien Tzu Shen, and I'll probably do another commentary where I spend a considerable amount of time talking about his work, his achievements, etc., because it bears repeating. They're really, really trying to push for a war between the U.S. and China now, on top of everything else. Dr. Hsien Tzu Shen was particularly interested in the course corrections of a missile, of an ICBM in flight, when he was kicked out of America. Get this. This is a key point to remember. I don't have time to get into it. One of his colleagues was Dr. Sidney Weinbaum, a communist. Weinbaum used to host parties, and a lot of the people that attended these parties were just normal people, friends on the faculty at Caltech. However, there was an inner core, essentially a communist cell, that attended these parties as well. And this caused problems later for Hsien. Turned out Sidney Weinbaum was a member of a communist cell, and eventually Dr. Hsien started getting harassed, had his security clearances revoked, and suffered a severe loss of face. But that doesn't mean that Dr. Hsien Tzu Shen was a spy. Indeed, Dr. Hsien Tzu Shen's wife was the daughter of a general under Chiang Kai-shek, nationalist leader of China. For 5 years, he was under virtual house arrest, was not allowed to leave America to visit his ailing father in China, likewise was not put in jail, and an incredible thing happened. They deported him. After 5 years of being under house arrest, severe loss of face, he was kicked out of America. Where did he go? Well, his ailing father was in mainland China. He went to China, communist China, received the hero's welcome, and became the father of the Chinese missile development program. He trained, under his guidance, future generations of Chinese rocket missile designers, technicians, theoreticians. He literally created from scratch the Chinese missile development program. And like I said, he was particularly interested in developing the means to correct the course, the navigation of missiles in flight. And it was under his administration that they created the whole series of Dongfeng, known as DF Dongfeng for East Wind in Chinese, missiles. And today we have the DF-21, which is known as the aircraft killer, aircraft carrier killer, excuse me. One of these missiles can take out a moving aircraft carrier underway in the high seas. They created the Guam Killer. This is the DF-26, which is a missile that will take out the American base at Guam, where in the past they deployed nuclear weapons. If you remember the 8-year war between Iran and Iraq, the U.S. reflagged a number of oil tankers through the Strait of Hormuz, reflagged them under American ownership, American flags, because they were afraid that the Iranians, who'd received silkworm missiles from China, would use them against the tankers. If you remember, it's a whole other story. The U.S. was secretly, at one point, arming and financing both sides, but particularly Iraq, to fight against Iran in that war. The silkworm missile was developed under the guidance of Dr. Sien Sushen. This is all relevant, and it ties in with what I've been talking about, how these different alien groups are deeply interested, on the one hand, with promoting a nuclear war, and other groups of ETs don't want a nuclear war because of the problems associated with some form of quantum entanglement where their worlds will be affected by what goes on here. So I've said for some time there will be warfare in the skies and eventually on the ground between rival ET groups. We've seen how some of these underground bases are jointly operated by humans and aliens. And in some of these joint human-alien underground bases, there are reptilians. And unfortunately, they seem to be the wrong reptilians. They're not benign. They're not friendly. They seem to be hostile. And that seems to be the groups or group that they're associated with. So I thought I would put this out there to give you my perspective. Really, if you really want to understand what happened to Dr. Sien Sushen, his career, all of his accomplishments, he was regarded as one of the world's leading authorities on missile development. It was outrageous for the U.S. to kick him out. And this went far beyond and far higher than the Immigration Naturalization Services, INS. Someone at a very high level said, let's kick him out. He'll go straight back to China and he will start their own missile development program. That's how it works. We know there was an apparatus in place to leak hemorrhage, in fact, on a mass scale, all these atomic secrets, uranium ore, fissile material, you name it, to the Soviets. So why wouldn't they do the same thing? These reptilian hybrid controllers on planet Earth, why wouldn't they do the same thing to jumpstart the Chinese communist missile development program? So I recommend Iris Chang's book, Thread of the Silkworm, the story of Sien Sushen, the brilliant, enigmatic, Chinese-born scientist who helped pioneer the American space age and when rejected by the nation he sought to adopt as his own, became the undisputed father of the Chinese missile program. The book is called Thread of the Silkworm. I have not heard one truther, influencer, podcaster talk about Dr. Sien Sushen. And this commentary has already gone on for over an hour. I just don't have the time to delve into it, this subject, on this occasion, but I will in the future. And I'll also talk about the problems that an American fleet will have sailing out towards the Taiwan Straits, because they're going to have to fight their way through a chain of islands. And these islands have been fortified with these ship-destroying missiles that the protégés of Dr. Sien had developed. So what we're seeing is the very real possibility of American aircraft carriers, American amphibious ships loaded with Marines, support ships, etc., as well as bases, Guam, Hawaii, anything within range, getting hammered by missiles developed by a guy who should never have been allowed to leave America. He was so important. He knew so much. It was sheer insanity to let him go. They should have apologized. It was all a big misunderstanding. And if they felt so strongly that he was a communist agent, they should not have let him go back to communist China. Anyhow, that's a key point I wanted to make, because we are that much closer to nuclear war. This, to me, is one of the primary reasons why we're seeing so many alien manifestations here. The drone excuse is ridiculous. There's open conflict in the skies happening in places like Las Vegas and other places. These are not drones. The real drones, the man-made ones, stick out like a sore thumb. They are fakes. You can see that. There's a lot of fakery going on. But where there's smoke, there's fire. So anyhow, I just wanted to run all that by you. There is so much more I could share, but time constraints being what they are, I just at this time, this point, don't have the time to do it. But I will say that I am having Jeff Brady back on the show. And here's the kicker, folks. Jeff Brady is, in my estimation, one of the best videographers and documentarians about aerial UFO activity. Where has he been based all this time? New York and New Jersey. There's no one who knows more about what the ET activity, UFO activity, in that region where a lot of this activity is taking place than Jeff Brady. So stay tuned. That podcast will be coming out shortly. Anyhow, everyone listening, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.